Okay, good. So welcome back. If somebody wasn't here, I think one or two people might not have been here in the first half. Quan Duc has just made his vow. it's cooking stuff. We won't say more, but hand over back to David Mitchell to continue.
Thank you. So yes, Quan Duc realised that hunger matches and hunger strikes and peace marches weren't really going to change the heart of a government. But just imagine the predicament they were in. They were, Buddhism is a non-violent tradition. You can't meet violence with violence. If you meet violence with violence, you destroy your own tradition. So how do you meet violence as a Buddhist? How do you respond to those who are bent on destroying it? And believe you me, they were bent on destroying Buddhism in Vietnam. So Quan Duc was a man of huge vision and imagination, but more than that, considerable grit, to put it mildly, and considerable, well, in fact, he seemed to be totally fearless. So he took this vow that he would, unless the government had a change of heart and would give religious freedom to the Buddhists who constituted up to 80% of the population, he was going to burn himself as an offering to the three jewels. Please take note. As an offering to the three jewels. It was not a protest. It was an offering to the three jewels. He always, from this point onwards, whenever he was asked about it, spoke of it, of what he was about to do, as an offering to the three jewels. Takes us back to the Lotus Sutra. So what happened next was that he sent a letter to the committee spelling out what he was going to do, or what he wanted to do, and why he did it, and asking for their permission. He wasn't acting in a void, he wasn't doing anything which might cause other people trouble, necessarily. He wanted to get people behind him. So he wrote to the committee. I've met two members of this committee. One of them is a monk who lives in Boston, Thich Nhat Hanh, and another is a very good friend who still lives in Saigon, Thich Duc Nhiep. And Nhat Duc told me that when they received this letter from Quan Duc, they were absolutely horrified. Nhat Duc said it was medieval. Nothing like this had happened for centuries. Actually, that wasn't true, but he didn't know that. there had been at least two other immolations in Vietnam that century. But under very, very different circumstances. Anyway, Nhat Duc personally was horrified and wanted nothing to do with it. In fact, I got the impression that most of them just didn't want anything to do with it. Although there's different accounts of this. It's difficult to know quite what happened from this point onwards. He gets very confused. There's another version of this, but at least that one monk, Nhat Duc, was horrified, wanted nothing to do with it. In fact, he told me that over the coming weeks, he was pestered by Quan Duc, who would go up to him and say, please help me fulfil my vow. And in the end, Nhat Duc got very fed up with this and dismissed him very, very discourteously on one occasion, and said, don't do it, you jump like an insect. And I think he later regretted having said that, by the way. But Quan Duc, typical of the man, just didn't react. He just went away quietly, smiled at him, left in quite a courteous sort of way. On another occasion, he went up to Nhat Duc. This is Nhat Duc's story, what he told me, and he actually bowed down to him. Now it's very difficult to communicate just what a big thing that is. An elder monk bowing down to a junior monk. You don't do it. It's shocking. Nhat Duc was shocked. But he finally the penny dropped with Nhat Duc that this man was really serious. Anyway, what happened was that Quan Duc had sent his letter, the committee had to consider it. There's only one answer they could give. That was no. They had to say no, at least in writing, to cover themselves. But there's another story which says that what really happened was they said no by letter, but a message went back verbally, the time is not right. So what had been going on in the meantime was that immediately after the Huey massacre, the government troops, or well, police, probably military, I can't remember, but certainly government, there was a siege taking place in Huey of the Two Dharma Temple, the temple from which the march had started to Radio Square. And there were about 300 monks, lay people and nuns trapped in there. No food was going in, no water was going in, and time was running out. So the monks in the committee were very much aware of this. They tried to get the government to back down. Government would have nothing to do with it. So eventually, they reached desperation point. In the meantime, Quang Duc had been quietly preparing himself. Duc Nhiep, the other monk that I met who was on this committee, told me that he'd seen Quang Duc every day reciting the Lotus Sutra in its entirety, three times a day. It doesn't leave you much time for anything else, frankly. He was either doing that or he was meditating. And Duc Nhiep told me he saw him several times doing this. But the desperation point arrived. And the committee met and they realised that they had a window of opportunity. Unless they acted very, very soon, the people in the temple in Huey were probably going to die of starvation. But what had been happening is that ever since the Huey massacre, every week, I think it was on Tuesdays, they'd marched through the city to commemorate the victims of the Huey massacre. So the following day, it was a Tuesday. If they did something on the following day, the police would not be suspicious because for the previous Tuesdays had been a march. If they did this on any other day, immediately their suspicions would be aroused. And, they were watched all the time. The secret police, news, infamous secret police were everywhere, watching what they were up to. Anyway, they decided to risk it. So they decided that the time had come to ask Quang Duc if he was willing to fulfil his vow. And the man who was given this onerous task was Duc Nhiep, one of the monks that I've met and interviewed on a number of occasions. So Duc Nhiep went to the Quan Am temple where Quang Duc had been staying. That was not his own temple, his own temple, Quan Te Am temple, where he was head monk. They thought it prudent to move him out of there, just in case word got around. So he was staying in the Quan Am temple. Duc Nhiep, sort of mid-evening, went to see Quang Duc. And he went to his room and asked Quang Duc, "Are you willing to fulfill your vow?" And according to Duc Nhiep, this is the way he put it to me, Quang Duc just smiled and said, "I'm willing to die for the sake of the Dharma in any place at any time." So Duc Nhiep probably gulped and said, "It'll have to be tomorrow morning." And he smiled in silent consent. That was the only real interaction that Duc Nhiep ever had with Quang Duc. But he told me that he said that when he met Quang Duc on that occasion, he said that his primary impression of him was of a very noble man. He said a true gentleman. He was tall, like a European, and very distinguished. Anyway, that's all it took. So Duc Nhiep said to Quang Duc, he got very, very businesslike, said, "Okay, please don't leave the temple until tomorrow morning. I've arranged for two young monks to look after you, personal bodyguards." Not that I think they'd have done anything violent, but anyway, there were two monks to look after him. And he told Clanduc, a cart will come at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. It might have been a little bit before that, actually. But anyway, it was certainly the following morning. So that's what happened. The following morning, the car came. And Clanduc was driven to the Phat Bút Temple, which is not very far from where he was staying. There was some sort of service in commemoration of the massacre. And then they went on a march through the city, with the car slowly driving through the streets and about 200 or 300 nuns behind. Now, overnight, Duc Niep had virtually worked a miracle. He had very, very little time in which to do what he did, but he organised it to a T. The most tricky thing was getting the Western press present without the secret police finding out. He informed the most trustworthy members of the press. None of them took it seriously, barring one man, Malcolm Brown, who took the famous photographs. Malcolm Brown of Associated Press. Malcolm Brown was with them from the point at which they started, from the point of the service at the Phat Bút Temple. Anyway, they went from the temple, and when they reached the junction of Lê Văn Duyệt Street and Van Dinh Phuong Street, Duc Niep had told the driver of the car to drive into the middle of the junction and then stop. As soon as that happened, all the monks and nuns from behind were to encirculate the whole junction and lie down, blocking all entry and exit. None of them knew what was going to happen. Duc Niep told me, had we told them, they wouldn't have turned up. They'd have been terrified. They knew something was going to happen, but they didn't know what. So the car pulled up into the junction, and the driver had been told, get out and open up the bonnet. So if there's any police around, they'll think the car's, something wrong with the car. It would gain valuable seconds. It probably did, and it was probably crucial. A monk from the back of the car got out. Clanduc got out from the front of the car. The young monk from the back of the car took Clanduc by the hand. Clanduc walked into the centre of the junction, sat down in full lotus, very, very upright. Malcolm Brown caught that on picture too. The young monk, shaking all the time, poured a 5-gallon can of petrol over him and then retreated. Clanduc then took out a lighter and flicked it. And nothing happened. And he flicked it again, and nothing happened. And again, and again, and again. Finally, he looks across at Duc Niep. No fire! Clanduc very coolly took out another lighter and threw it to Clanduc, who caught it, just as a policeman was breaking through, trying to stop him. He flicked the lighter, and he exploded in flame. I can still hear Duc Niep describing this to me. He said, it was a hill of flame! And he said that the intensity of the heat was such that he had to retreat several metres back. And he said that Clanduc sat perfectly upright in full lotus the whole time, and burnt to death until his body finally fell back after about 10 minutes. And that's what actually happened. Now, Clanduc had left 3 letters behind. One to his disciples, basically just saying there should be no tears. One, a fuller, lengthier explanation as to what he'd done and why he'd done it. And for me, the key passage in this is that he said of himself, I cannot sit tacitly and watch Vietnamese Buddhism be destroyed. The third letter he left was for President Diem. It's written in the most courteous style you could imagine. I have the honour of presenting my regards to President Diem. May he please have compassion on all his people, not just the Catholics. Very simple, very to the point. Now, I think that letter to President Diem is worth dwelling upon because, so far as I'm concerned at least, it makes it absolutely clear that Quang Duc was not politically motivated. What I mean by that is that he wasn't trying to bring about a regime change. He's trying to bring about a change of heart in the government. Hopeless task, not with those people. But on the other hand, he gave them the opportunity. He gave them the benefit of the doubt. So that's pretty much what happened. Well, at least that's as near as we're ever likely to know what happened. There's so many different accounts of what happened on that confused day. But the immediate consequence of Quang Duc's action was that the following day, Malcolm Brown's photographs were on the front page of just about every newspaper across the world. Very importantly, one of those newspapers was lying on President Kennedy's bed when he woke up in the morning, the Baltimore Times. New York Times refused to take it. Anyway, on the front page was this Malcolm Brown's famous image of Quang Duc burning. And according to his brother, Bobby Kennedy, his immediate reaction was, "Jesus Christ!" You know, he could not believe what he'd seen. And was deeply, deeply shocked, deeply horrified. Later that morning, he got on to an aide to contact the deputy ambassador in Saigon, because the actual ambassador was off on holiday at the time, saying that he must immediately communicate with Diem and make it clear that unless they adopted a more accommodating attitude towards the Buddhists, then they might have to reconsider their funding. So money counts, does it not? So, very much to Madame Nu's disgust, she accused President Diem of weakness. He called a halt to the Tudan siege, and those people were released. It's almost certain that Quang Duc saved their lives. I just mention that because this is one of those details of what happened that people are generally unaware of. It's worth bearing in mind when you consider the ethics of what he did. There's so much more I can say about that. There's so much more to this wonderful story, actually. So many more details I could give you, but I don't have time. It's already 9:06, and we have to finish shortly. I haven't said anything about the ethics. I'm not going to. I'm sure you've got questions which are connected with the ethics of what he did. Maybe I'll just simply leave you to put those questions to me, or any other questions that you have. We don't have to dwell on that. If it's not an ethical issue for anybody, well, fine, we don't have to go into it. But usually someone has a thought or two about it.
Well, I do.
Okay.
Well, do I really need to explain what? Like,
I might guess what your question is. I think I probably can, but perhaps not everybody can.
Well, one would wonder if it's ethical to end life even though it's yours. So I think that's just... I cannot put it in more details than that.
Sure. Well, that's the usual issue that comes up. Was what Quang Duc did a matter of suicide? And, of course, it depends how you define that, but... from a Buddhist point of view, the issue is, I suppose, what was motivating him? Was he committing an act of violence against himself? I certainly would not describe what he did as a suicide. Mainly because of all the sort of associations with that term. I mean, most people who commit suicide, as I understand it, do so on the basis of what we'd call an unskillful mental state. They do it either out of self-hatred or because of some kind of psychological disturbance or out of depression or even, in some cases, because they want to spite other people. There's a whole sort of string of negative emotions which usually underlie what we consider to be suicide. But bear in mind that from a Buddhist point of view, what decides whether an action is unskillful or skillful is the underlying mental state, what it was that motivated the action. From what I understand, from what I can see about of Quang Duc, what I know about the man, what I've heard, what I've been told about the man by those who were interacting with him at this time, and from people who knew him even when he was younger, I have no doubt that he was acting from a skillful motive. He was doing the only thing that he could, I'm sure, in order to sort of preserve the Dharma in Vietnam. He cared that much about it. And bear in mind, many of his friends had been lost. He commented upon this in one of his letters. He said, "They bury us alive. They torture us to death." This was going on. I mean, there's no question of it. It's documented in Quang Duc's letters, if nowhere else. And so he's very, very concerned to bring that to an end. So the trouble is, though, he did take his own life. And we find it very difficult to separate the taking of even one's own life from the idea of violence. But the way that I choose to see it is that you have essentially one way of functioning or acting which has two sides to it. One aspect is expressed in, let's say, negative terms and the other in positive. Putting it in negative terms, it's non-harming. Putting it in positive terms, it's compassion. You can't separate those two. The sort of principle of non-harming is simply compassion expressed in negative language, as it were. I have no doubts that Quang Duc was acting or was motivated by compassion. He saw suffering and he wanted to do something to bring it to an end. That's how it strikes me. Those who I met who were with him at round about that time said that he seemed to be in a very, very positive mental state throughout the weeks leading up to his immolation. Not the slightest hint of a negative emotion. Jacques Duc even told me that he'd asked Quang Duc on one occasion, "Don't you hate the government?" And Quang Duc just smiled and said, "No." So Jacques Duc pinched his arm and said, "Does that hurt?" And he said, "Yes." Left it at that. But he couldn't believe that anyone couldn't possibly hate the government, even this man. So I don't know whether that answers your question, but that's the way that I would answer it. I don't consider what he did to have been an act of violence, in other words. That's to say, an act based in hatred of any kind, or delusion. Yeah?
And it seems, from what you just said in reply to the first question, that you can justify his act from a Buddhist point of view based on the correct motivation that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And the intentions that he had. To what extent do you think that his act is justified by the consequences that it brought about? And would it be harder to justify what he did if it actually turned out to be the case that it produced negative consequences and that the government had, maybe responded even more aggressively and oppressively towards Buddhists?
Well, actually, the gain that they had was very short-lived. But the immediate consequence was that the siege of the Chudan temple was lifted. And almost certainly he saved the lives of those people. But you can never know what are going to be, the total consequences of any given action, no matter how skillful it is. And it's even possible to act skillfully and for others to react unskillfully as a consequence, but in a way to your skillful action. But you're not responsible for that. You can't be. If they choose to act unskillfully, they have to take responsibility for that. You're not responsible for that. I mean, one of the criticisms that you will read by Well, I mean, various analyses have been done on Quangbuk's action, and the main criticism which comes out is that look at the consequences. You've got Jan Palach in Czechoslovakia, who burnt himself to death. An American Quaker, burnt himself to death outside Robert McNamara's window at the Pentagon. And there's a whole string of these sort of things happening. But you can't blame that on Quangbuk. If you behave in a skillful sort of way, and other people act on a copy on the basis of less skillful motives, you're not responsible for that. How can you be? Yeah?
So given what you've just said, which seems to be that the ethical significance of his act is, in your view, entirely contained within his motives for acting, how does that sit with what you said earlier in the talk, which was that the consequence of his act, the saving of the lives of those 200 or so people in the temple, was important ethically for us to consider?
Well, he didn't, but he. I think it's just worth bearing in mind that there were some positive consequences to what he did, because usually all you get is a string. Is an analysis of all what people consider to have been the negative consequences of what he did. That's why I mentioned that. But he didn't specifically do what he did in order to relieve the Tudan siege any more than he acted in order to bring about the downfall of President Diem's regime. Even though all political analysts point to Quangbuk's immolation as being the trigger for the downfall of that particular regime. Quangbuk himself does not try to bring about the downfall of the regime. I'm sure he would have been aware of the siege of the Tudan Pagoda and would have been concerned. But he had a much bigger concern than that. He didn't do it specifically for the Tudan siege. Yeah?
Well, I was actually really inspired when you first started talking about this, to get a bit off topic. When you started, where this all started for you, and it's been a long time, I suppose. So I just wondered what was next for you with this whole thing.
Some of my friends are worried. At least two of them think I'm going to follow his noble example and disappear in a burst of flame. They needn't worry. But nonetheless. He is definitely one of my heroes, and a hero in the sense that he's someone who I consciously try to emulate. However, I don't. That what I'm trying to emulate is the qualities which I see that he embodied, not the specific action he committed. I mean, yes, I would like to think that I could develop. Could develop such heroic qualities that even I, at some point, would be willing to sacrifice my life for the Dharma if it was necessary in extreme circumstances. But I know I'm a long way from that. But, it certainly has an appeal to me. You've been trying to ask for some time, we'll come back to you.
You said it wasn't a protest, but it seems like it was done in reaction to the way the Catholic regime was treating the Buddhists. And wasn't it done, and they got the press there.
Yeah.
So wasn't it done to stop that?
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to consider what Quangbuk did and what the other monks did. They basically took advantage of his vow. With his full... He was perfectly happy about that, but... Sorry, but what was...
You said it wasn't a process, but to me...
Oh, that process, the word process. Yeah, let's have a look at that. I said that, personally, I would not describe what he did in terms of process, because normally, perhaps not always, but certainly only too frequently, process is associated with anger and hatred. And, anger against or hatred for those who are causing you pain or who are oppressing you in some way. And there's not a hint in his writing or in the man's character to suggest that he was motivated in any way by hatred. He just seemed to be completely clear of it. So that's why I'm very reluctant myself to use that term. Maybe, strictly speaking, you could, but you'd have to qualify it considerably to satisfy me. When I spoke with Jacques Duc about Quan Duc, he was the one who reacted to Quan Duc trying to sort of constantly, as he experienced it, hassle him into helping him to fulfil his vow. He said that he'd only ever, throughout the whole course of his life, when I met him, he was in his mid-70s, throughout the whole course of his life, he'd only ever met one other monk who possessed anything like the degree of utter tranquility that he always encountered with Quan Duc. Yes, it was quite extraordinary. So you could almost, it almost radiated from him. So those sort of comments, and there are similar comments that I could mention, suggest to me that he was a man who was genuinely free, at least from all grosser forms of hatred. And he is universally considered by Vietnamese Buddhists to this day as having been a living bodhisattva. They don't speak of Thich Quang Duc, they speak of Bo Tat Quang Duc, Bodhisattva Quang Duc. You had a question, yes?
Thank you. I have a two-part question. So, first one was, how does such an extreme act kind of reconcile with the middle path, the Buddhist teaching of the middle path, and avoiding kind of extreme acts of indulgence or asceticism?
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts about that. And the second one was something you yourself mentioned in the talk, was how do you meet violence as a Buddhist?
Yeah.
That's something that I'm always kind of struggling with, being confronted with huge acts of social injustice, trying to not condone them, but also not be violent in response.
Me too. It's difficult. But what your first question, remind me.
Middle path.
How does that fit? One of the most strange questions that I have ever been asked, and I've been asked it more than once, what's the difference between what he did and the 9/11 bombs? And of course the most obvious thing is that he didn't harm anybody else. I'm not sure if he's going to answer your question, by the way, but it's worth going down this track, we might get there. So what Quang Duc harmed nobody in doing what he did. And I would say, arguably, I would say he didn't even harm himself. He took full responsibility for his own action. He knew perfectly well what he was doing. He knew he was not going to survive. But he had a mythic sort of backdrop in which enabled him to do that, I suppose, from the Lotus Sutra. I suppose it's maybe you could consider that it's the middle way, because it is there's no violence involved. Some people will argue that perhaps there is. I'm arguing that there isn't. But it's free. It's a way. It's above and beyond violence. And I suppose the duality of violence and non-violence. He acted transcendently, as far as I'm concerned. That probably does that. Look, I tell you, your question is very difficult to answer, and it's the sort of thing that I've puzzled over myself, because I find myself deeply inspired by what he did, and can't entirely understand why. And the way that I've experienced it, when I sort of try to sort of get underneath it all for myself, it's as if certain things in life, you dwell upon them, and gradually you can work out, you can come to an understanding. You can work out what's going on. With what he did, it's like it comes in at me sideways, and I'm sort of left confused by it. But I have no doubts that he was motivated by compassion. I can't answer you better than that. You have a question at the back.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you were saying that people over hundreds of years, when they were reading the Sutra of Golden Dragon, the White Lotus Sutra, and then they fed themselves to tigers and set themselves alight, and how that was deluded because it's meant to be symbolic and, doing a literal thing. So, I mean, in your mind, so what's the difference? Why
Does
it feel heroic and inspiring?
I think that, there's a very good book, I can't remember the author's name, I've met him some years ago, but a very interesting book called Burning for the Buddha. And this gives a historical account of self-immolation within Chinese Buddhist tradition. And he gives many, many accounts, quotes many, many sources. And, you know, there's none of them, to my mind, have anything of the flavour of what Quang Duc did. My overall sense is that these people had missed the point. With Quang Duc, I don't feel that way. He was responding to a desperate situation. It really was the cremation ground, the crucial situation. It demanded some kind of bigger response, some kind of super imaginative response to bring about some kind of resolution to what was going on. I don't really get that kind of sense from the other accounts that I've read. I mean, for example, at the moment we know that there are many Tibetan monks who have been immolating themselves. Now, I don't know enough about this, and I don't really know what to make of it, but looking at it, it seems to me, from the little that I do know, that they're sort of politically motivated. You don't get a hint of that with Quang Duc. Also, with the Tibetans, there is no history of self-immolation. Absolutely not. It's just come about in recent times. In Chinese and Vietnamese tradition, it's been there since the beginning of the 4th century. So there's a whole tradition behind what Quang Duc did. I just wonder what the Tibetans are doing. I don't mean to, you know, I'm not saying I don't sympathise with their predicament and so on and so forth, but I'm simply mentioning it because it seems to me that it feels different from what he did. And I can't honestly completely explain to you why. It's just the more I dwell upon it in my imagination and mind, it just seems to me that there's something transcendent about it, something that you can't in the end, that I at least in the end cannot explain. But yet I find deeply moving and deeply inspiring.
Just to clarify, so it's mostly lay people that are self-immolated
in Tibet? There have been one, two months. It's mostly lay people?
Yes, yeah,
right. Okay. But I think there are. I think some monks have done it as well, haven't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
right, okay.
But mostly it's lay people.
Okay.
And
that's
second
part. Oh, yes,
but
indeed.
How do you need violence as a Buddhist?
Oh, boy. How do you meet violence as a Buddhist? Depends who you are. Some of us meet violence with violence. I suppose. In extreme circumstances, you'll never know until you're confronted by it, I suppose. I would like to think that if I was confronted by someone who's bent on destroying me, that I would not react with violence. But I can't guarantee that I wouldn't. But what I try to do throughout my Buddhist life is conduct it as fully as I possibly can in accordance with that principle. But I can't say what I do in extreme circumstances.
If you see extreme social injustice, for instance.
Oh, if you see that. Well, okay, well, I do encounter that in India. We all do, we go out there and teach. The only thing you can do is to try and do something positive in response. And so what I'm trying to do is to give something to those people who've suffered as a consequence of the caste system. And I take great pleasure and joy in that, because it's clear to me that they really do benefit from what I give, and they're very, very appreciative. I can, if I allow myself to dwell upon it, get very angry with caste Hindus. And sometimes, actually, I have done. But I try not to, because it doesn't help me and it doesn't help them. It's just me being reactive. It's my problem, not theirs. It's my anger. It's me who's getting angry. It's not them making me angry. I am allowing myself to get angry. And that's what I've got to stop doing. Does that kind of help? Of course, it won't satisfy everybody, but I think that I don't know of any other Buddhist approach. In the end, we all have to take responsibility for our mental states and for what we experience in life.
I find I need a healthy balance of anger to keep me motivated. I find I need a healthy balance of angry versus or peaceful mental states, you know, to keep
if you do get angry, try and sort of give it a positive chat. You know, if I think about the caste system, I do get angry about what's happened to people I know in India. But then I want to move my energy into helping those people rather than, you know, hating those who've caused them pain. Yeah?
Just to go back to the Tibetan.
Yeah.
I think one of the complicating factors, which was an aspect of
Kwangdo. Kwangdo is another man. Another famous monk, actually.
Kwangdo was saying how they very cleverly got the media presence, and became known because of that huge media coverage.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the complicating factors with Tibet. Mm. I don't know this for sure.
Yeah.
But it is a fact that self-immolations, there's nearly been 120 in Tibet.
Gosh.
Since the first one in 2008.
Right.
But that is what gets the media attention. And Tibet is one of the most inaccessible places in the world.
Mm.
Very, very hard to get information out. So I don't know this for sure, but it would seem, it's quite probable, that to a Tibetan self-immolate, they know that they're getting the message out to the world.
Mm.
About the extreme human rights oppression and suffering. So it's a sort of double-edged sword, isn't it? And
well,
yet it's seemingly having very little effect.
Well, and they will surely all have been aware of what Kwangdo did. Because it hit world headlines. That was Duk Nyep's expertise. Kwang Duk did it, but Duk Nyep organised it so brilliantly.
I guess what I'm saying is,
yeah,
when you feel that desperate,
yes,
as I think Tibetans do,
yeah,
in general, you think, what can I do,
yeah,
to save my people and to change the situation?
Yeah.
And you know that is what draws the world's attention.
Yeah, and that I can understand, but let me also say that even though the monks in Saigon, the younger monks in Saigon, clearly did feel quite desperate, and actually they were in a desperate situation, you don't get a hint from Kwang Duk's writings of any sense of desperation. You certainly get a sense of his concern, but again, it's just something which is absent, which is why I had such admiration for what he did. He was not acting desperately, and he did it. I mean, he took a vow for a start. He asked for permission to do it from people who are effectively his juniors, and he acted fully in a very, very, well, totally responsible way, I would say. Yeah.
What were the circumstances you mentioned? Two other immolations that were under very different circumstances
in Vietnam.
Yes, and also, do we see actually the burning in at the beginning of footage of it in Bergman's film Persona, where a nurse?
I don't know. I mean,
horror, she's lost the ability to speak.
Well, there was newsreel footage. You can see newsreel footage of Kwang Duk burning on YouTube. You can also see Madam Nu's response to it, which is interesting. I clap my hands at another monk barbecue show. Actually, I don't think she says that. I don't think she said that clip's on YouTube, but she did say that. She admitted it. I think in a radio interview. But it could be that they used that clip. Let me just say one more thing about that. Some of you may know Sara Matty, who's an American order member, and is my age, mid-60s, so he was around when this happened, and he said the impact of Kwang Duk's assimilation upon America was really huge, because the Americans were already getting involved in Vietnam. And he said it completely shifted the attitude of the vast majority of Americans towards involvement in the war. Unfortunately, it didn't stop Cardinal Spellman from promoting the war, but, you know, he said most Americans were not in favour of it, not at all. And Kwang Duk's immolation was a major factor in shifting the attitude of the average American to what was going on. So someone had a question? Yes, again.
at the beginning you said you, if you had time, you might mention how to regard this act as significant for us.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I'd be quite interested to hear maybe some of the ways in which you think it is important for us to take into account in our daily lives.
Well, I think the first thing is just to, it's not so much his immolation as to bear in mind the context in which he acted. Buddhism was under severe persecution from a Roman Catholic regime. Effectively, it had been under attack from Catholicism ever since the Jesuit missionaries arrived in the 17th century. But what gradually happened was that they made it impossible for people to practice Buddhism. They enacted laws which didn't even recognise Buddhism as a religion, for example. I can't remember all the details. I've got them somewhere, but they made it very, very difficult. They went around, especially in rural areas, forcibly converting people. Convert or die. That's what happened. And I mention that because we are so lucky. We can do what we like. We can practice Buddhism. No one's going to bat an eyelid. We're very fortunate. It's not always been like that. It may not always be that way in this country even. So I think it's just worth reflecting upon the fact that we have things very, very easy. We're not persecuted, not at the moment. But historically, Buddhism has suffered the most terrible persecutions. Buddhism has been on the defensive for 1,000 years, according to one Buddhist scholar. It's just gradually disappearing from the world. It's suffered at the hands of Islam, at the hands of Marxism, and at the hands of Christianity. What was once a huge tradition in dominating a whole region of Asia no longer is. So it's more that really that I mean. It's rather than his immolation specifically. Just reflect upon how fortunate we are to be able to have the freedom to practice Buddhism as we do. Nonetheless, personally, I try to use Kwan Duk I take him as a kind of exemplar for myself. If I find myself being a little bit timid or anxious about something, I ask myself, what will Kwan Duk do? I don't feel like going to India because I've got a toothache and I don't want to go to an Indian dentist. It's happened to me a year ago. I had a horrible horrible problem with the tooth, and the tooth had to come out, but my dentist didn't have time to take it out before I left for India. What was I going to do? So I just asked, I didn't want to go, actually. It was pathetic. So I just asked myself, what will Kwan Duk do? Just go. So I use him as a sort of a motivating force from within myself. Whenever I feel I'm about to turn and wimp, I try and think.
You didn't burn
That's
your
tooth. Sorry?
You didn't burn your tooth, did you?
No, actually, I managed to survive. I did go to a dentist, but he didn't sort of stick any needles in me, which was what I was most concerned about. I managed to survive with a bad tooth for 2.5 months. Put it fixed when I got back. Yeah.
In your opinion, how important is actually successfully completing the act itself? If Kwan Duk's
sorry,
friend,
completing
the act itself. So if Kwan Duk's friend, whose name I've forgotten, I'm afraid, didn't have a lighter, and this had resulted in a petrol-soaked man being arrested, would you regard that as a better outcome or worse outcome, or actually it makes no difference? It's just willingness to do it.
I think it would have been a very unfortunate outcome simply because we wouldn't have had those pictures from Malcolm Brown and it wouldn't have had the impact, and therefore there wouldn't have been pressure put on the Catholic regime in Saigon to change their tactics. But there was huge pressure eventually put on the regime, and when they started getting up to their old tricks again, they got rid of the existing ambassador, US ambassador, who was useless, and they've got a much tougher character in place, Cabot Lodge. And the moment he arrived in Saigon, he said, a change of regime is necessary. From that point onwards, the...
so that was not Kwan Duk's intention?
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't at all. He was trying to change their hearts. But nonetheless, what he did really galvanized the Buddhists, and the whole, a whole Buddhist protest movement emerged as a consequence of that. The monks became much bolder. They weren't acting violently, but they really began to stand up for themselves, and they paid the price, made them one, you know, suffered terribly as a consequence. But that was all part of what eventually brought about the downfall of the regime. I mean, actually, it was out of the frying pan into the fire in the end, because once the Viet Cong had overrun Saigon in 1975, Buddhism again underwent the most terrible forced persecution at their hands. Many people were killed, especially Buddhist monks just disappeared, concentration camps, etc., etc. And to this day, it's difficult for monks in Vietnam, unless they toe the party line. Yeah?
If I understood correctly, so this action is considered skillful because it doesn't have any violence. Does the action of self-immolation you consider it skillful because it didn't have any violence?
Well, I would say in Quang Duc's case, I'm convinced.
In that case.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to say that it always has been.
Okay. Is there any case in which you could take, somebody could take somebody else's life and still doing it in a compassionate way? And what's the difference?
I can't imagine that.
So not even cases of euthanasia, for example.
Sorry?
Cases of euthanasia, for example, whereby you know.
What about euthanasia?
Yeah.
Got a long way from quite a
bit. That would be compassion at the end of the day, I mean.
I think we're going to have to wrap up this one.
Yes, okay. Shall I just say a little bit about this and then we'll wrap up, because it is time. It's quite a loaded question, isn't it, euthanasia? I mean, it involves somebody taking somebody else's life. I certainly wouldn't myself like to find myself in that position.
Wouldn't you be doing this in terms of coming from a compassionate...
I think that I imagine that it could be done on a compassionate basis, but I haven't really thought sufficiently through the ethics of euthanasia for myself. I've talked with some of my doctor friends about it, and I know what some of them think about it, but I just really, it's not an issue I've given an awful lot of thought or reflection to. I don't really feel competent to answer that. Whereas with Quang Duc's self-immolation, I dwell upon it for years now. And I feel sure of my ground, and I can answer your questions about that. Mm. But I think we'd better stop there, because we've run out of time, haven't we?
So I just want to say a very, very, very big thank you today, Mr. Phil. Well, I found it both sort of inspiring, gripping, but also a very sobering evening, challenging evening. And just want to sort of thank you for sharing so fully your inspiration, I can see that it is an inspiration, an act of devotion for you to come here and do this. I also want to just say that David Mitra is trying to, in a way, tell the story of Quang Duc as widely as possible, because it isn't a story that's well documented, despite its recentness in history. And one of the ways he's doing that is by he's writing a film script. David Mitra used to work in the theatre, and he's writing a film script that he's trying to get made into a film. It's a fictional account, I believe, involving what happens to Quang Duc. The reason I say that is, well, A, watch out for the forthcoming film, who knows when. I very much hope it is made. But also, if anybody out there knows of any people who might be able to help David Mitra, either in the script or in terms of contacts, directors particularly.
Producers, actually.
Producers. then do, well, probably get hold of me. And let me know, and I can pass things on. Because David Mitra's, after his India trip, he's got 9 weeks in India, and then he's going to go on a solitary retreat for 9 months, which again is gorgeously impressive and a courageous thing to do. But for now, I just want to thank David Mitra for a very, very inspiring evening, and I hope that, well, maybe after your solitary, perhaps next year you can come back.
Oh, please.
and your inspirations with us.
Thank you
very much.